It's the 25th of August 2017. On the podcast today, I have Joe Solomon, Managing Director of Oilex. OEX is ticker there. Joe discusses their recent review conducted by Schlumberger and Baker Hughes of their Cambay asset. Also on the podcast, Neil Ricketts, CEO of Vesarion, VRS ticker, gives an update on progress at the company, specifically on the prospects for its graphene sector of the business. Also, financial analyst with Spreadex, Connor Campbell, talks about Petrofac, Hayes, and Restaurant Group, all of who have results out next week. And as always, I have the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 3 or 4 hours, and the top five most liked RNSs on the platform this morning.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Joe Solomon, Managing Director of Oilex. It's OEX ticker. Joe, thanks for joining me.
Thanks, Justin. Pleased to be here.
Okay, you've had an RNS out, quite significant of late, entitled Core Analysis and Review Confirms Cambay Potential. Before we get into the detail of that, Joe, could you go through basically what Oilex is all about and also specifically the Cambay area?
Yeah, look, we have had for a number of years a potentially really high-value project in India. It's a tight gas project. It's potentially got multi-trillion cubic feet of gas in the ground, reservoired in what we call the EP4 zone. And the company has been working to bring this into commercial production for a number of years. What we need to do, because we know the gas is in the ground, we need to increase the gas flow rates by adopting the North American shale type approach, where you drill horizontal wells and then stimulate the wells to increase the exposure to the reservoir for the gas to flow. Our previous attempts to commercially unlock this, in fact, we drilled the first horizontal stimulated well in India to do it, but we've been only partially successful, and delivery of the higher volumes of gas has eluded it. So what we did was we went out, we appointed two very well-known, internationally known companies, that's Schlumberger and Baker Hughes, to undertake some studies on core samples that were taken from a well that we drilled a few years back. And their scope was to provide us advice, firstly, on what stimulation technology will work for our rocks in India, and secondly, to review what had happened in the previous wells, to try to get learnings to go forward, to highlight problem areas, and identify changes that we would need to make in future programs. So that's really what it was about.
Yeah, so they've undertaken the review and the case study here, Schlumberger and Baker Hughes. So you got the results back. Tell us the outcome, please, Joe.
Yeah, the study results came back better than we had anticipated. A really pleasing result. Overall, the study didn't identify any fatal flaws, and it gave us a series of recommendations to go forward using techniques and equipment and product which is readily available. Nothing in this report gives us any real warning signs. So, you know, it's important to understand in these types of projects that no rocks are the same, and the solution you build needs to talk to the local geology, the local rocks, to get the optimum results. They repeat this in the US and Canada time after time. So just looking at some of the detail of what came back to us, our rocks are a little softer than the normal rocks that they work with in North America. And we wanted to know whether this was going to pose a challenge to initiating and propagating fractures that we need to get exposure to the reservoir. And one clear thing that came out was that this is not the case, and there's no concerns about this. The study went on to look at the old wells and came back with a series of very specific findings and key conclusions. So in the old vertical wells, our stimulation efforts, which we know were at best only partially successful, we now know from this study that they were ineffective because the fractures weren't contained within the reservoir. We also know that with the horizontal wells, they had been the proppant that you introduce to hold open the fractures had been overflushed into the wellbore. And so the slightly softer rock means that if you don't have enough proppant immediately adjacent to the wellbore, the rocks can squeeze back in on you. And so we really didn't have any connection between the fracture and the reservoir and the wellbore itself. They also said very specifically, we need a stronger proppant to avoid crushing of the proppant and to avoid the fractures from closing. And then they looked at the fluids that we used for drilling and completion, and they said, you need to do very specific things here. You have to have certain fluids for certain phases of the stimulation program rather than the single type of fluid that we'd used before. So the study confirmed what we broadly knew, that every basin is different and the devil's always in the detail. And, you know, the detailed core analysis had not been done previously. So we're now feeling very buoyed by this. There are no negative factors, and we have a series of identified procedures and processes that we can carry going forward. And as I said before, none of these are tricky. None of these are especially problematic, and everything is available for us. So it has revalidated the value in our Cambay project. We're really happy about that.
Yeah. So, you know, encouraging results, and it features, like you said there, no negative indicators, which would seemingly, degrade the project. So where to from here?
Well, we have to submit an application for an extension to the contract that we have with the Indian government for this block, for the production service contract. And that extension application requires us to submit a plan for how we're going to go about working in the field for the next 10 to 12 years. So that plan is complete. It's a full plan that involves all of the subsurface G&G and engineering work. It involves all the commercial and economic works. I must say it's a really good piece of work, and we're really pleased with it. Our Indian office really has to be congratulated for that work. We've had great cooperation and support from our joint venture partner and the government of India in preparing the application and the supporting documents. And we'll submit the development plan next week, and the application documents for the extension very shortly thereafter. So we are ahead of schedule on our Indian project.
Marvellous stuff. Well, if someone's listening to this, Joe, and they like the sound of this study and what the outcome was, seemingly very positive, and they're not following you yet on Vox Markets, could you give them three reasons why they should hit that follow button, please, on your page?
Yes. Look, as I've said before, the potential of this, our main project in India has been revalidated by industry-leading experts, and we can continue to move forward to commercializing the large undeveloped gas resource that we know is there. On top of that, our team in India is very capable. They continue to meet every objective to keep us moving positively ahead with this project and, in fact, with our other projects. On top of this, we are continuing to review additional growth opportunities. We need to have a greater depth to our portfolio and to increase our exposure to value creation for the company as a whole. And we're working along those lines, looking at a number of new projects. It's interesting that at a time where the industry is at a low point, we think that there are good projects still out there, and we've retained capability to be able to review and capture them. So things are looking good for us, I have to say.
Excellent, Joe. Good to chat to you, and hopefully we'll chat again very soon. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Justin.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Neil Ricketts, Chief Executive Officer of Versarian, VRS ticker. Neil, thanks for joining me.
Thank you very much, Justin. Always a pleasure to talk to you.
Yeah, now, listen, I know about you, and I think you are standing in a very exciting space there. But for people not aware of Versarian, Neil, give us a brief summary as to the business, please.
Sure, Justin. I mean, we're in an engineering group that specializes in developing new materials. Probably one of the most exciting materials that we're currently working with is graphene. And we purchased the spin-outs from the University of Manchester, and more recently, the University of Cambridge.
Mm-hmm. Now, you are, like, you know, like lots of companies on AIM, you are a revenue-generating company. I think it was 5.9 million, I think, last final results there. And you're splitting into two areas, like thermal and hardware products, more sort of traditional kind of things, but also graphene and plastic products. Now, I assume that the exciting part here, the focus here for you is probably graphene, is it?
Yeah, pretty much 90% of everything I do now is focused around the graphene. We've got a really, really exciting prospect. And what we need to do that now is what we specialize in, which is taking it from the laboratory and getting it out to big multinational companies.
Yeah, and for a while, graphene has been touted by you know, many people, including experts around the world, as you know, the most exciting product or commodity of its that anyone's seen for years and years and years. But this, like anything, it takes a long time to transition from R&D to commerciality. Now you are on that edge there of doing this. So, but what areas? Because graphene is a huge world. You know, it can be applied to so many different industries. Unbelievable. So, what areas of graphene are you focusing on, Neil?
So again, as you describe, a truly fascinating place to be at the moment, huge amounts of opportunities, and we need to remain focused. So not all of these opportunities will happen quickly, and so we need to focus as a young company on the ones that are going to get to market in the shortest time. So for us, it's carbon fiber composites, it's plastics and polymers, and it's batteries. And we have research projects and commercial arrangements in place with all of those.
Okay, so when you say composites, what kind of industry would use this, for example?
So if we talk about carbon fiber composites, the big push is for automotive and aerospace to reduce the weights so that they can start to electrify, you know, battery-powered cars, battery-powered planes, lighter, more efficient vehicles. It's a huge area of development at the moment. Not much has changed in the aircraft industry for a long time, but over the last 10 years, we've seen them adopting more and more carbon fiber composites, and now they want to push that envelope even more. So they want even lighter vehicles, and that means that you know, we are dealing with some of the largest companies in that area, and unfortunately they're not very, very fast to move in some instances, and that can be quite frustrating for a small agile company like ourselves, but it is part of that industry. Automotive tends to be a bit quicker, and then at the bottom end we have, you know, consumer goods, and we're starting to see carbon fiber used in far more applications, including sports goods, you know, carbon fiber fishing rods and carbon fiber golf clubs, and where there's a real performance gain. So those are the areas that we concentrate on in terms of carbon fiber composites.
Okay, and what about this sort of you know, powders and inks, and are you in that space? And also, you know, tell us the applications here, if you could.
The applications are far stretching. So if we talk about inks, which came as part of the acquisition from Cambridge Graphene, we're talking about flexible electronics. We're on about putting things into your clothes, or putting things that can bend and be flexible. So again, a lot of automotive applications, a lot of applications around glass and buildings. There'll be a time when we don't actually use cables like we use at the moment, but we'll actually draw the circuits on the wall or paint the circuits on the wall. And so this is an area that's rapidly changing, and we're at the stage now where we're talking to people who are making those changes.
Yeah, and what I mean, what kind of, obviously you can't mention any companies per se, but give us an example of, say, someone maybe you're not involved with, or, you know, who would you get, you know, get an advantage from these kind of powders and inks? What would they do with it? How would they use it?
So if you think that a few years ago, you know, I'm sure you can remember as I can, that the car used to be a relatively simple device. You know, you got in it, you drove it. If you were lucky, you had a fuel gauge and a speedo. Well, now the amount of information that's required is just simply staggering. And so all of the systems in the car have to be packaged within the same sort of envelope. So there's a big push to try and save this weight, and trying to get the electronics predominantly much smaller and much better packaged, so that the cars can be much more efficient. But even in terms of, if you think about, you know, what's happening in the world of automation, for automated cars, you know, the Tesla is already able to drive itself. The cars need to talk to each other, so we'll need far more antenna, we'll need far more electronics in the car, and that's what the car companies are all concentrating on.
Yeah, cool. Well, listen, since we last spoke, Kim, you released your finals, but since then we've not heard from you. So, I mean, you know, I understand you can't say too much, but what have you been up to, Neil?
I mean, the bottom line, Justin, is we're just frantically busy, and sometimes we have to make priorities. We don't, as a company, tend to put out all the news that we have at our disposal because we don't think that it's genuinely market sensitive. More recently, we've become associate members of the Graphene Flagship, which has a 10 billion euro pot of money. We've had circumstances where we've been very successful in research grants with Innovate UK, and we have a great relationship with Innovate UK. They've even asked us to demonstrate our products and have a stand at their show in November, where all of the large companies will be going to look at new technology. But more importantly, we've been doing a lot of traveling to customers. So every day it means it's another research center with another large company and starting the process of getting these products out there. So our process is fairly simple. We start with a non-disclosure agreement with the company. Then we look to negotiate a development contract, and then we look to get a commercial order. And all of these companies are somewhere in that process. Okay. We're probably dealing with over 100 blue chip global companies, which is a lot for a small team. And so we've had to expand our sales team. We've had to look at the way that we're producing. We've had to look at the quantities that some of these large companies are going to request. And it's all good news for investors. And as the second largest shareholder, I'm delighted at the progress of the company. And, you know, obviously we've got our AGM coming up in September, and we look forward to talking to our investors about what we've been up to.
Yeah.
But the bottom line is we've just been busy working.
Yeah, exactly. And so some of these discussions you're having with these big companies, I mean, like you said, some of them can be slow moving, but, you know, when they do move, it'll be transformational, I suppose, for you. But are there any you can see happening sooner rather than later?
Yes, definitely. I mean, there's a bit of a pecking order. Some companies move much quicker than other companies. Some companies are working on projects which are much, much more difficult, and so they will be longer. But some companies have access to technology which is developed now. And so we're looking at getting those products out into the market.
Are there any, Neil, that you've come away from and you've done a meeting with and thought, you've walked out the door of their building and thought, wow, if that happens, that's amazing.
Yeah, I mean, I can't name names, unfortunately, because of the strict confidentiality that's in place. But only last week, I was out at a major tire manufacturer's global R&D center. Mm-hmm. And when we started this business 6 years ago, there is not a chance that I ever thought that we would be sat down with the global CTO of a massive brand talking about using our technology in almost all of their products, and it's a massive opportunity for us. And I've been around the block a few times, and I've never been in a company where we've had the opportunities that we've currently got in front of us.
Yeah. So, and how did that go, that meeting?
It was absolutely fantastic, and we're just in the process of getting an NDA through their legal team. They have more people in their legal team than we have in the whole company.
Wow.
They're very excited. One of the downsides to being in the graphene area is there is a lot of misinformation out there. There's a lot of hype. What we're keen to do is to always demonstrate independent data, always show that the proof's in the pudding, and get on and do stuff. So we're supplying material for people to look at and to test. And, you know, the opportunities that are available to us, Justin, include everything from one of the leading manufacturers of clothing for big brands, some Chinese companies out in the US. And in fact, you know, I'm due to go out to California later on in September to talk to some of the largest companies in the world.
Wow, marvellous stuff. Well, Neil, if anyone's listening to this and like the sound of these prospects but are not following you yet on Vox Markets, could you give them three reasons why they should hit that follow button, please?
Yeah, sure. I mean, we are ideally placed in the graphene field. We came out of the University of Manchester and University of Cambridge, and we have some fantastic links. The second thing that I always think is important is that we are revenue generating. We have a substantial business behind us, which is continuing to grow. And in fact, sales are up 25% this year. And the third thing is that and I always like to remind investors that my interests are closely aligned to the rest of the shareholders, as I'm still the second largest shareholder in the business.
Marvellous, Neil. Good to chat to you. And hopefully next time we speak, we'll be revealing one of these big news items we've been chatting about. So speak soon, fella.
That would be fantastic. Thank you, Justin. Always a pleasure.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Conor Campbell, financial analyst at Spreadex. You all right, fella?
Very good, thank you.
Cool. Now, we look at what's coming up in the week ahead, results-wise. So, what are the big plays? And do you know what? Was it last week you covered, I think? In fact, WPP, not good results from them, was it?
No, awful from them. But then today we had a Computer Centre. I think they've shot up like 18% or something.
Let's have a look at that. It has made we're 15% at the moment. So good results from them. Okay, so what are we looking at? Who's releasing next week, Conor?
Well, first up, we've got Petrofac on Wednesday. If you're talking about bad years, then you sort of, you struggle to find one worse than Petrofac, really. All centred around a two-week period, basically, in May. You know, before that, things were going all right. It was a pretty bog-standard year. There wasn't, much of interest. Its full-year figures in February were pretty solid. It eked out a net profit of $1 million compared to, a net loss of $349 million the year before. So things moving in the right direction. Revenue was up 15%. However, in mid-May, the Serious Fraud Office revealed that it was investigating the company in connection with sort of suspected bribery and corruption charges related to the Serious Fraud Office other investigation into Una Oil in Monaco, which I think that's been going on for a while now. Obviously, that news in and of itself, I think that wiped off 15% in value straight away. Around 2 weeks later, Petrofac said they were suspending their COO, Marwin Chedid. That again, investors sort of took that as a bit of a warning sign and lopped off another 30% in value. So the stock was, destroyed basically within 10, 14 days in May, and hasn't really stood much chance of, bouncing back since. It's lifted off of its lows. It was doing pretty poorly around, around June, July. But since then, sort of a series of sort of positive updates, mainly things like recently announced there was a $2 billion deal in Oman. It sort of had a steady stream of new contracts and things like that to show investors that whilst this, very major issue is still ongoing, we are, relatively business as usual. We're still finding new contracts. People haven't been put off going to Petrofac for using their services, which I guess is, one of the big things. Like, does this investigation damage the company's reputation so much that people are put off, using their services? So far, that doesn't seem to have been the case. I think in terms of Wednesday's figures, obviously the Serious Fraud Investigation is going to be the main focus. Any comments along those lines are going to be of great interest to investors. Recently, the company hired sort of a top city lawyer in Edward Sparrow to deal with the management of and response to the investigation. So that shows that there is some serious stuff for them to deal with. I think investors will be hoping that all of the bad news, the really bad news, is out of the way and that the investigation can sort of progress now and that, a lot of stuff is on the table. But obviously, it's an investigation. Plenty more dirt could be turned up. So it is, it's a tough situation for Petra. Its financials are still, they're pretty solid. Earnings are expected to jump 2.6% to around 40 cents per share, But again, it really depends on if there's any more bad news in relation to the investigation.
Yeah, that's what's hanging over it, isn't it? I mean, if you look back in April, it was just over, it opened. Let me see there. It closed, actually, in April, £9.23 a share on the 4th of April. And now it's down to £4.30, from £9 down to £4.30. And it has bounced a bit. I mean, it did hit like £3.45 at one point. It's up at £4.30. But yeah, like you say, it's that big weight, isn't it, that's hanging over it, that pressure of the investigation, and you feel until that's cleared up, then the shares won't bounce. But it's one of those things that, you know, if it does clear, and, you know, the day after it clears, then it's going to jump. It's going to open up massively. So it's almost like, is it worth taking a risk? Get in there and just put a little bit of money in as a punt, you know, to beforehand? Because you find also this kind of thing has happened, not in investigation, but if you look at IGG, a very similar chart because of, you know, the regulatory pressures around spread betting came into force in there, and the government released that thing, and they got clamping down and all. And there's share price dropped off a cliff, but it's slowly started to recover, even though you haven't seen any clarity on that yet. But you're thinking, yeah, financially, they're fine, but how, you know, it's a risk. You know, it's a big risk, but it could pay off if it comes out all clear, the FCA investigation. But there we are. All right, what else are you looking at, fella?
Hayes report their full year figures on Thursday. It's an interesting one, really. You know, there's plenty of uncertainty looming over the UK jobs market at the moment, obviously Brexit-related uncertainty. And Hayes hasn't been immune to that. It's sort of throughout its three main updates this year, that has been a constant presence, really. It's half-year figures back in February. It said that for the, you know, 6 months following the Brexit vote last June, the private sector had suffered a marked step down in activity. Its net fees in the UK fell 10% and 15% in London specifically. However, the strength of Hayes' business outside of the UK is such that it's sort of managed to still post some pretty healthy figures. Like those half-year figures in February, still managed a 3% rise in like-for-like net fees. Pre-tax profit was up 17%, despite operating profit in the UK being down 29%. And it still hiked its dividend 5% to 96p per share. So it's still doing very, very well, even with the you know, the fairly substantial weight of an incredibly gloomy and uncertain UK job sector. Similar situation in its third quarter figures in April. It actually managed an all-time record quarterly net fee performance, despite UK like-for-like net fees dropping 4% again in the fourth quarter. UK comparable net fees fell 5%. It said that there was no long-term investment in sort of any of the sectors it covers in the UK because of the lack of clarity on Brexit, and, you know, the fact that that uncertainty will likely continue for the next 18 months at the very least. It also said that there was tough market conditions in the public sector, where net fees fell 17%. It did say there was some improvement in the private sector, and the private sector being the main issue, the main net fee. I think net fees are made up about 72%, 75% from the private sector, so that is the one to watch, really. But again, like I said, despite those issues in the UK, like-for-like net fees in the fourth quarter were still up 7%. So it's the kind of business that has really managed to weather the pretty heavy issues in the UK. In terms of its full-year figures on Thursday, Hayes said that operating profit is sort of expected to be around 209.5 million at the moment, which would be a 16% increase year on year. But it expects that figure expects the eventual figure to be a bit higher than what is expected at the moment. Mm-hmm. So again, I think investors will be looking for that, you know, that operating profit increase. But I think there'll also be, what will be key will be its guidance for the next financial year. Specifically, is there any chance at all that the UK division can return to growth? So far, it hasn't been too much of an issue for the company stocks. It spiked end of April, start of May, and has drifted since then. I think it spiked around the 176, 177 mark, and has drifted since then. But now it's back to around 172. It's not too far away from the highs it struck around April and May, which obviously got the boost of the UK election then as well. But I think it's going to depend on what kind of signals it sends out about the UK job sector. But like I said, that's not the be all and end all for Hayes. It's well positioned in Asia and around the rest of the world and in continental Europe. Yeah. That even if the next 18 months do remain fairly subdued in the UK, it's got enough substantial growth elsewhere to keep the key figures buoyant.
Yeah, anyone buying here, though, buying at the highs, you know, and it's tested this level before on the chart. You can see it back in, when was that? In fact, back in 2015, it hit this level and went from 170, 175, where it is now, 172, went all the way back down to 90 pence, and then back up, and recently hit this level again, failed to break through, and it's come back a little bit. So if it breaks through, it would continue higher, I think. But it'd be interesting to see if it does do that. But it's at its highs on the chart. Anything else, Connor?
Yeah, finally we've got Restaurant Group also reporting on Thursday. It's their half-year figures on Thursday. It's just looking at the chart, it's been a messy year for Restaurant Group. It's really struggled for any firm direction. There's been some pretty huge movements, you know, tending to come after their sort of string of reports, like, you know, 10-15% jumps or falls here and there. It sort of plunged at the end of January. It's the fourth quarter like for like sales were down 5.9%, which is a really ugly figure. And it said that Frankie and Benny's, which is, I guess, its sort of key brand, needed substantial price and proposition changes, you know, in order to be revived, basically. Then you cut to its full year figures at March, and it rocketed higher despite confirming like a 3.9% fall in annual like-for-like sales, alongside an 11% dive in pre-tax profit. The fact that it maintained its dividend, basically, and B, you sort of announced this massive turnaround plan that included beefing up its its presence in UK airports, reducing the price of the Frankie and Benny's menu. I think it was taking it from 5 items under £10 or less to 22 items under £10 or less, as well as, you know, closing certain, you know, unsuccessful sites, basically, and I think, you know, using that money to fund the UK airport expansion. The fact that it announced that turnaround plan sent it, you know, spiking higher in March. Then again, cut to the start of May, in its first quarter figures, you know, it sort of fell between March and May, spikes again in May, despite like-for-likes falling 1.8%. That was obviously a huge improvement on the 3.9% drop seen in 2016. It surged 10% in May, but then fell, you know, a few days later due to profit warnings from other companies in the sector. It's really hard to sort of get a handle on what Restaurant Group is doing market-wise. There's no... it's not that, you know, investors react well to... seemingly have reacted well to the last couple of updates, a bit seemingly receptive to this turnaround plan they're trying to implement, but the gains don't last, and then, you know, it sees these huge spikes, and then, you know, within the week after whatever report, it tends to have shed most of that growth.
So
I think in terms of next week, it's hard to tell, really. You know, in terms, you know, if you're going by what's happened in the last few reports, it could be in line for a spike higher. It really depends on if there's been any sort of improvement in the last quarter or so. You know, they want to see signs of improvement in Frankie and Benny's, and if customers have been receptive to the price changes to the menu and things like that. But again, it's hard to ascertain exactly how investors are going to react to the report on Thursday.
Yeah. Well, again, on the chart, though, you know, I've added this to my watch list now, because the chart there is on really substantial support levels. It hasn't dipped below £3 substantially, you know, since it's had that big fall-off. And it seems like just basically trading in the range between, you know, £4 and £3. And I'm thinking, if that dividend's safe, which is, I don't know, showing around 4-5%, you know, and they don't have a bad set of figures, then it may see a bit of a climb up from here, because, like I said, it's in that range, just needs to break it. Hopefully it breaks above rather than below. Marvellous stuff, and, you know, if it does go above, then celebrate by going to Frankie and Benny's and getting a couple of balloons and listen to some cheesy old music. Marvellous, Connor. Thanks for that. Have a nice weekend. Speak next week.
You too. See you next week.
Okay, it's time for the top five. Most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours. At five, it's always there, pretty much in and out. It's one of the top most followed companies of all time, 88 Energy, that's ATD ticker. At four, Frontera Resources, FRR, not seen that for a while, hopefully coming on the podcast soon. At three, Dixon's Carphone, DC Dot, that's after the big drop of go yesterday. They blamed it on expensive handsets, people not renewing, and roaming charges in Europe going down. And I think that anything that's fragile, you know, takes a hit like that, almost 30% wiped off the stock. It's a bit worrying, but you now and again, I'm just going to look at the price right now. You do have a bounce back on a big fall off like that. It's almost overdone. And I liken sort of a stock market of price action in companies. It's like a pendulum sometimes. It'll go one way quite strongly, then the other way, not as strong, but quite strongly anyway. And that's what happened with, PFG, which is Problem Financial Group, goes a while back, fell by 75% in one day. That was after about a 30-40% drop anyway. So, you know, a lot was wiped off his stock price, but then it's rebounded massively. And I left the party a little too early on that one, I think. But, a profit is a profit is a profit. £9 at the moment. I got it at £6, buying it at £4.50. That's annoying. Anyway, crack on. At two. Oh, talk of the devil. Provident Financial, PFG. And number one most followed company on Vox Markets in the last 3 hours is also the most followed company of all time. It's there again. And I think people are waiting for RNS here. It's for Ascent Resources, AST. Okay, top five most liked RNSs are, at five, NCCL Energy. That's NCCL, Project and Funding Update. At four, Metal Tiger, MTR, Final Chemco Economic Contribution Assessment. At three, Strategic Minerals, SML, Proposed Directors and Management Options Program. At two, Edenville Energy, EDL, Project Construction Update. And number one, most liked RNS, released via the platform this morning, as voted for by your thumbs up, is SDX Energy. Ticker there is SDX, 2017 half-year financial and operating results. That's it for the podcast. Have a nice weekend. Have a nice bank holiday. And I'll speak again Tuesday. Much appreciate.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
The Financial Times guides you through complex issues. In divisive times, don't settle for black and white. When you need the full perspective, turn to FT.com. Become a subscriber today. Search for FT subscription.